Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're on a very specific mission. We're going to move past the really well-known ground of the three and eight witnesses. And instead, we're going to look at seven other individuals who also claim to have been near or to have even physically handled the foundational plates.
It's a necessary step, really, because the cool number of people who claimed they saw or handled the gold plates, even if they were just wrapped in a cloth, it actually comes to 17.
17. Wow.
Yeah. So we're doing a deep dive into the sources for these other less talked about accounts. We're looking at court records, lewd interviews, family autobiographies, that kind of thing.
And the goal here for you listening is to synthesize all of this. We really need to figure out if this group of additional witnesses provides overwhelming evidence for the plate's physical existence.
Or, on the other hand, if these accounts, which often come much later, actually introduce so many contradictions and, frankly, physical impossibilities that they weaken the whole story.
So what's the first thing you notice when you start digging into these sources?
Well, what's immediately clear is a pattern. These accounts, they're often popping up decades after the event, or they're secondhand reports of what somebody else allegedly said.
So that time gap is a huge issue.
It's a massive issue.
Yeah.
It means the descriptions, the size, the color, the timeline of who saw what when, they become wildly inconsistent. It makes it almost impossible to pin down what this object was supposed to be.
Okay, so if the big challenge here is the difference between a controlled, guided story and an unguided one, let's start with maybe the most uncontrolled witness of all, Josiah Stoll.
A perfect place to start.
Who was he, and why was he around Joseph Smith so early on?
Stoll was a local farmer, and this is the key, one of Joseph Smith's first employers. He's the one who hired Joseph as a glass looker or a seer.
So he was part of that treasure digging world.
Exactly. They shared that same sort of magical subculture. That context is really important to remember.
And his claim is a big one. There's a letter from 1843 from a Martha Campbell, and it suggests Stoll claimed he was the very first person to handle the plates when Joseph brought them home.
Right. Stoll reportedly said something like, "Blessed is he that seeth and believeth." He was an early and very enthusiastic believer in the whole thing.
But the second we go from that enthusiastic claim to an actual description, things get complicated. We have a published account from one of Joseph's court trials. This one's in 1832, where Stoll testifies.
And under oath, he says he only saw a corner of the plate.
Just a corner. And his description of that corner is just, it's unlike anything else we hear.
It really is. He described it as resembling a stone with a greenish cast.
Mm-hmm.
And the size, he said it was about 1 foot square and 6 inches thick.
A greenish stone. And that size is massive. That's like a slab of rock, not thin metal leaves. No other witness ever mentions the color green.
Never. And it creates another, even bigger problem. Joseph's story was always that he was commanded not to show the plates. That if he did, quote, "I should be destroyed."
An immediate death sentence.
Exactly. But here's Stoll seeing a corner of them without Joseph even knowing. And Joseph is not destroyed. The divine command is broken on day one with no consequences.
So the fact that Stoll's unguided description is so different suggests that when Joseph wasn't in control of the experience, the testimony that came out was just completely different.
Completely. It was unique and totally inconsistent with everything that came later.
Okay, so we go from an outside observer whose account throws everything into chaos to the most intimate observer, Emma Hale Smith, Joseph's wife.
Right. If anyone could verify the physical reality of the place, you'd think it would be her.
So what was her story?
Well, in an interview from 1879, so we're talking very late in her life, she said the plates often just lay on the kitchen table, wrapped in a small linen tablecloth.
Just sitting on the table.
Yeah, she said she would feel them, trace their outlines, and even move them around when she was dusting.
So she's living with them, cooking near them, cleaning around them. But the details she gives about their physical properties, that's where the first real red flag for the material science comes in.
It is. She described them as seeming pliable, like thick paper.
Pliable.
And she said they would rustle with metallic sound when she would, you know, thumb the edges.
Okay, stop there. If these plates are gold or even some heavy alloy and they're thick enough to be engraved on both sides, they should be rigid. They should be heavy. They absolutely should not be pliable like thick paper.
It just doesn't compute. That description suggests an object that's maybe cumbersome, but not nearly as heavy or solid as a stack of metal plates would have to be.
And the very idea that they were just on the table being moved around for dusting, it completely clashes with that sacred, forbidden narrative we heard with the stole account, doesn't it?
It's a tension you see over and over in the sources.
Yeah.
This miraculous object that requires absolute secrecy and divine protection is, at the same time, treated with this shocking casualness inside the Smith home.
Speaking of narrative tensions, Emma gives us one of the most famous and one of the most verifiably false claims about Joseph himself.
Ah, yes. Her claim that Joseph could neither write nor dictate a coherent and well-worded letter.
And that line is used all the time by defenders of the faith. The argument is that an uneducated man like that couldn't possibly have written something as complex as the Book of Mormon.
Right. It's a cornerstone of the apologetic argument.
Yeah.
But if you actually look at this historical record, it just doesn't hold up.
How so?
We have letters. We have existing, coherent, well-worded letters that Joseph wrote himself. There's one he sent to Emma in 1829 that's a perfect example.
So her claim is just demonstrably false.
It is.
Yeah.
And it suggests that Emma, late in her life, was actively shaping the narrative. She was trying to defend his legacy, maybe pushing back against critics who suggested Joseph used a pre-existing manuscript to create the book. She was adapting the story to fit the needs of the argument.
That's a fascinating insight. So if Emma represents the internal inconsistencies, both with the prop itself and with Joseph's biography, let's shift to the external spiritual confirmations, specifically the ones given to people under a lot of stress. Let's talk about Mary Musselman Whitmer.
Mary Whitmer's story is really telling. Her situation was, well, it was difficult. Joseph, Emma, and Oliver were all boarding at her home while the translation was happening.
So her workload just exploded.
Dramatically. All the chores, all the stress. And it's important to remember, the Whitmer family operated firmly within that magical worldview. These divining rods, for instance.
And Mary's big claim is that an angel appeared and showed her the plate specifically to relieve her stress.
That's the story. She was supposedly going out to milk the cows, murmuring to herself about how hard she was working, and this old man appears to her and shows her the plates to strengthen her faith.
It's amazing how often these divine interventions seem to happen right at a point of extreme family pressure or personal exhaustion.
It's a recurring theme. But with Mary's story, the real problem is the source itself. This event was first published in 1878.
So 49 years after it supposedly happened.
49 years after the event. And get this, 20 years after Mary Whitmer herself had died.
Wow. So there's no way to verify it with the primary source.
None at all. And that kind of delay, it allows for all sorts of embellishment and narrative shaping over time.
Mm.
And even the identity of the divine messenger is... let's say muddled.
Muddle how?
Well, David Whitmer, her son, described the man as a heavy-set, gray-haired man in brown woolen clothes. He eventually calls him Moroni. But Mary Whitmer, according to the accounts, always referred to him as Brother Nephi.
So they can't even agree on which ancient prophet showed up in the yard.
Exactly. The identity and the physical description of the resurrected being are confused, even among the family members claiming to have seen him.
And the later accounts just add more drama, right?
Oh, absolutely. By 1888, the story has evolved.
Yeah.
Now the personage unties a knapsack, he shows her the individual leaves, and then he suddenly vanishes. The further away you get from the event, the more cinematic and detailed it becomes.
It just begs the question, if this profound personal miracle actually happened, an angel comforting a tired mother to validate the foundation of a new religion, why does it stay a secret for almost half a century?
And why does it only surface in these second and third hand accounts? It's a major credibility gap.
Okay, let's shift back to the Smith household itself. Because if you try to put the stories of Joseph's siblings together about the day he brought the plates home, it's not just contradictory, it's actually impossible.
It is. Let's start with your mother, Lucy Mack Smith.
Lucy's testimony is a wild ride.
It's a textbook case of a story changing over time. In 1842, she told a visitor, a man named Caswell, that she had actually seen and handled the plates. She even described them in detail.
And Caswell noted that he thought she was basically in on the deception. We should also remember, Lucy had a clear financial interest in these relics, right? She was displaying the Egyptian mummies and charging people to see them.
That financial context is crucial. But then later, in her own autobiography and other interviews, Lucy completely reverses her story.
She denies seeing them.
Completely denies it. She says she was not permitted to see them and that she only hefted them while they were wrapped in cloth. The church today only claims she lifted them.
So she goes from seeing and describing them to just feeling the weight.
Right. It shows how fluid the testimony was around that central command, who was allowed to see and who was just allowed to feel.
And her son William, Joseph's brother, he focuses heavily on that weight.
William is pretty consistent on that front. He describes a package wrapped in a toe frock or a pillowcase. He estimates the weight at around 60 pounds, which is a key detail. He even claimed he could raise the leaves through the cloth and feel that they were metal, a mix of gold and copper.
So he's adding physical details.
Yes, and his account also really emphasizes Joseph's need to be strictly obedient this time around, because he had supposedly disobeyed before, which led to that 4-year waiting period.
Which brings us to Catherine Smith, Joseph's sister. Her accounts of that morning are by far the most embellished and, well, the most unreliable.
They're the least reliable, for sure. The first time we even hear about her interacting with the plates is 118 years after the event and 45 years after she had died.
That's an incredible time lag. And she doesn't have one story, does she? She has several.
She has three, and they are completely mutually exclusive.
Okay, what's scenario one?
Scenario one is the action movie version. Joseph rushes into the house, totally exhausted, because he's just fought off three men who jumped him from some bushes. He throws the bundle into Catherine's arms and tells her to hide them.
Okay, very dramatic. What's scenario two?
Scenario two is the quiet, domestic version. She's just dusting a room, finds the plates, and she ripples her fingers across the edges through the cloth and hears a tinkle of sound.
A tinkle. That little detail makes no sense. If they're heavy metal plates wrapped tightly in a thick cloth, they're not going to tinkle.
Not at all. And then there's scenario three, which comes via her granddaughter. In this one, Joseph thrusts the package into her arms and whispers, "Hide them," just as a mob is raiding the house trying to find him.
So wait, was it a calm family affair where William could carefully inspect the package? Was Joseph fighting three guys in the woods? Or was there a full-blown mob attacking the house?
You see the problem. You can't put the accounts from Stoll, William, and Catherine together and create a single plausible timeline for that morning. It's impossible. It really highlights how these secondary witnesses were just retrofitting their memories decades later.
Which implies there was no single consistent narrative to begin with, at least outside the core group. Okay, let's touch briefly on one more. Lucy Harris, Martin Harris's wife.
Right, who is usually painted as a villain in this story because of her skepticism, which is what led to the loss of the 116 pages.
Her skepticism is a huge historical fact. The church has a reason to downplay her testimony.
They do.
Hmm.
But Lucy Max Smith's autobiography gives us an interesting story. It reports that the skeptical Lucy Harris had a dream where a personage showed her the plates and described them very minutely. And after this dream, she supposedly donated $28 to the cause.
So the dream is used to basically neutralize her skepticism, and it happens before any of the official witnesses even see the plates.
Exactly. This dream, reported through Joseph's mother, retroactively validates the plates. It makes the biggest skeptic come around, even if it's only in a dream, right at the very beginning.
So if we pull all the way back now, the macro view that's often presented is that the church can list a total of 17 people who saw or handled the plates. And that sounds like an overwhelming amount of evidence.
That's how it's designed to function. It sounds impressive, but when you do the micro view, which is what we've just done, you see that those accounts are wildly contradictory. They're often secondhand. Some are just physically improbable, pliable paper, a greenish stone.
Or they just show up way too late in the historical record to be verified.
Exactly. The selective presentation of just the names, without all the contradictions that come with them, it really deprives you, the listener, of true informed consent about the source material.
So we've synthesized these claims, and what we found are these persistent structural inconsistencies. The color, the size, the material of the plates, and the chaotic circumstances of how they even arrived.
And it's this constant need to retrofit details that's so telling. Pay Orson Pratt, for instance. He was not a witness to the plates.
Right. He came along later.
But in 1859, a full 30 years after the fact, he's describing the engravings.
What crucial detail does he add?
He says the engravings were stained with a black, hard stain so as to make the letters more legible and easier to read.
That's a very practical, technical detail.
Incredibly practical. But no one else, not one of the witnesses who claim they actually saw or handled the plates, ever mention this black stain.
It sounds like a detail added decades later to make the whole idea of reading from these plates seem more, well, practical.
And that raises the final provocative question for you to think about. If a key detail that makes the plates readable, this black stain, was invented and added 30 years later by a non-witness, just to make the story more plausible.
What other necessary details were added over time?
Right. What other details, like a tinkling sound, or pliable paper, or conflicting stories about mobs, were added over the years to manage the growing credibility gaps in that original, much simpler narrative? I'd say go explore the sources for yourself.